All right, opening your Biblias into Job chapter 1. I hope that you're there. Job is an exciting book. So Job is one of the first books of the Bible that I personally read. And one of the things that was really interesting to me about Job is how often after I read it, people would ask me questions that their answer to that question was in the book of Job. Like, there are so many questions that relate directly back to the book of Job, and it's not so much that Job addresses so many things, it's that the few things Job does address are so widespread and on so many people's minds. One of the main questions that Job is thinking about is, why do good people suffer? And what do you do in that suffering? That's a massive question that comes up in the book of Job, and that's also a massive question that people will ask you all the time in life. And that's not the only thing that comes up in Job. And I mean, I'm not going to spoil too much of it, but like, Job is a cool book. And it's an interesting book. And it's a story that contains a lot of conversation. And so it's a 42 chapter long book, and we're going to be going through it in 6 weeks. Which means that there are some nights where one lesson is going to cover 10 chapters. And so we're going to be burning through this bad boy. And we're going to try to give you the Cliff Notes version of the book of Job. And then at the same time of that, you'll be going home each week and reading the chapters that we're talking about in youth group the next week. So it'll be kind of a high view of the book of Job, and then you'll have opportunities to ask questions and whatnot. So this, what we're going through today, is the introduction of the book of Job. It's the beginning of the story, as well as kind of the fundamental things you need to know going into the conversations between Job and his friends. And some other cool things about Job: Job is one of, if not the oldest book in the Bible. It was the first book written, most likely. Job was likely a contemporary of Abraham, meaning he lived around the same time as Abraham, which puts him hundreds of years before Moses was born. And Moses wrote the book of Genesis, which means that this story happened and was being passed down before the Pentateuch was written. Job is kind of like a prequel to the Bible, in a sense, where a lot of the questions that come up in Job, it's like God's setting you up for the answer. So I'm not going to spoil those either, but there's some cool things in the book of Job. And if you read the book of Job thinking about the fact that at the time this happened, none of the rest of the Bible had been written, it casts an interesting light on the events. Like, for us, we live and we have the entire Bible. Job had none of it. Job didn't have a single page of scripture as he was living through these events. And so that's going to be an interesting little thing. But let's just start into it. In verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." And so the first thing that you need to understand about Job is that Job is a righteous man, and that's important. Job is established as a righteous man, but then in verse 2, "There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 300 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants." So that this man was the greatest of all of the people of the East. So in the East, Job is the richest man who's alive, and not only is he the richest man, but Job is a righteous man. And so the thing that you should be seeing here is that this is not a situation where you have some rich man who earned his money by cheating and stealing. This is a person who has it good, and in a sense, you could say that they deserve to have it good. Like, Job has more than anyone else in the East, and there's no one else in the East who probably deserves it, quote unquote, as much as Job does. So Job is a righteous man with a lot to lose. And that's important. There's no one else in the East with as much to lose, and there's no one else in the East with as little reason to lose it. So if you continue, "His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did continually." So he's not only concerned with his own spiritual well-being, he's so concerned with his kids that every time they hang out and have a party, he offers sacrifices on the off chance that they might have sinned in a way that he didn't know about. So Job is like really, really extra, is basically where we're at. And so we move on, And we've seen Job, and we now know who Job is, but there's another character that we're about to be introduced to. In verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord." Now, when the Bible talks about the sons of God, that's often a reference to the angels. Son of God usually means that God created you. So Adam is referred to as a son of God in the Luke genealogy, and then angels are referred to as the sons of God, not only here but elsewhere, and then Jesus is the son of God, but not quite for the same reason. So the sons of God is a way to refer to angels. "And they came to present themselves to the Lord, and Satan also came among them." So this is an interesting thing. We see God and we see Satan, and now that we've got both of those two in the room, we're going to see how they interact. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it.'" So one thing that's important, who is presenting themselves to whom?
Wait, say that again?
Who is presenting themselves to whom? Who came to who? Satan came to God. This is important. This is one of the major questions that Job addresses, actually. A very popular philosophy in the modern day, in media and elsewhere, is the idea that good and evil are two coexistent, equally powerful things that are constantly at war with each other. You'll find that all the times in movies, even in Star Wars, that you've got the light side and the dark side, and the two are always in balance. And so it's a concept that makes its way into the human consciousness very frequently, and it's kind of interesting. But one of the things that Job immediately establishes is you have God, who's essentially the entity behind good, and you have Satan, who's essentially the entity that's behind evil, and they are not equally powerful. Satan is presenting himself to God, and then God is questioning Satan. It's very clear who's in charge. And so one of the important things that we learn from this circumstance is that evil is not more powerful than good. Good is more powerful than evil. God is more powerful than Satan. And that's going to be interesting in just a few verses. And so Satan, and then in verse 8, "And then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?'" So God's bragging. He's like, "Hey, Satan, where are you coming from? You see Job? How do you feel about Job? He's pretty cool, right?" And then in verse 9, "And then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face.'" And so Satan proposes a bet. And let's see if God takes him up on it. And then in verse 12, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." So here's something that's kind of crazy. Job is an extremely righteous man, and then Satan says, "Let me rock his world." And God doesn't say, no, he's been righteous. God says, "Go for it. Just don't touch him." And so there's two things that we're learning from this. Thing number one, how much is Satan allowed to do to any individual person?
What God allows him to.
What God allows him to. Satan is allowed to do what God lets him and nothing more. What do you think Satan wants to do?
More.
Satan wants to do more. And we've broken this up into the three story beats of this section, but the first one is the destruction of Job's possessions. The destruction of Job's possessions. There is a lot of S's in this word. So in verse 13, now that Satan's been given permission by God, in verse 13, "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' And then in verse 16, and while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And verse 17, and while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And verse 18, and while he was still speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead.
That's tough.
And I alone have escaped to tell you. That's very tough.
Like,
which
fire came down from heaven and burned his...
Yeah. We get two nomadic raiding groups, the Sabians and the Chaldeans, who come and they wipe out Job's servants and possessions. And we get fire coming down from heaven, destroying more of Job's possessions. And we have wind coming from the east and destroying Job's kids. So here's a few things that we learn about Satan. This is another reason why Job is important. Job is actually a really important book for the study of angels and demons. What do you notice Satan has the power to do? Lots of things. Destruction. Satan controlled nature. Satan sent fire from heaven and destroyed Job's possessions. Satan sent wind and knocked down the house that Job's kids were in. Apparently, Satan's got power over nature. Additionally, Satan has extraordinary ability to influence people. Two separate raiding groups. Not one group that decided to hit Job in two places. Two separate raiding groups. Satan influenced them and got them to wipe out Job's possessions. And here's the other thing. Satan is brutally intelligent. Not only was Satan able to wipe out everything Job had, he was able to influence a bunch of raiders, influence another bunch of raiders, and then also influence nature. And he knew how fast each of the four servants he left alive would run so that Job would get all of the news in one moment, where while this guy is still talking, this one who came from a different place after a different set of events comes running and cuts him off at the pass, and then the second guy, the third guy, the fourth guy. Satan not only has the power to do these things, he has the intellect to do them and time them so that Job gets the news at exactly the worst time. Satan is brutally powerful. In Jude chapter 1, verse 9, it says, but Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, words, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Which of us is as powerful as Michael the archangel? None of us. Michael the archangel is probably the second most powerful angel in existence, second only to Satan. So literally in the hierarchy, it goes God, Satan, Michael. There are some people that talk a lot about like getting into it with demons and trying to like, I hear a lot of things. Like people who are down to dabble in tarot cards or whatever else, people who are down to do like Ouija boards, people who talk about like, you know, punching Satan in the face and getting at those demons and whatnot. I just got to tell you, man, I'm scared of demons. I'm very scared of demons. Demons are dangerous and they should be scary things because I'm not stronger than a demon. And even Michael the Archangel wasn't willing to insult Satan. The only thing that keeps Satan from any of us or from anything is that God doesn't let him do it. And so your faith should not be in your ability to resist a demon. Your faith should be in God's ability to resist a demon. Demons are horrifying. And so Satan's got extraordinary power over a lot of things. And let's just think about Job again. Job has more to lose than anyone else in the East. He has less reason to lose it than anyone else in the East. And in a single moment, in the span of about a minute, he finds out that all of it is gone. Every animal, and all of his kids.
And all his servants.
And all his servants.
All his
Everything Job has, just like that, gone. That's brutal. That's insane. And let's see what he does. And then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. Whoa. Yeah. That's not typically how people respond to that sort of thing. Why is God doing this to me? This isn't fair. What did I do to deserve this? Come on, God. You and I had a deal. And so one of the things that's extremely important, and this is one of the main lessons that we're learning from this story, Job responds in the correct way. Sometimes people have this idea that my righteousness, if I'm a good person, then I'm a good person, I do the things I'm supposed to do, and in return, God gives me the things I want. God gives me a life I enjoy. God gives me the things that I pray for. If I'm a good person, then God's my personal genie in the sky. And that's not the case. Job is a perfect example of someone who was righteous, who suffered anyway, not because he deserved it, and then he responds by worshiping God anyway. And in verse 21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Which this is kind of major. One of the things that I find with people is that they'll talk to me about, you know, someone who dies in their 20s. They get in a car accident because someone else was drunk driving, T-boned them in the middle of the road, and then the 20-year-old who was like an honor student in college, they die, and then the drunk driver gets away scot-free. And maybe they go to jail or whatever, but one of them's dead and it's not the drunk driver. And they'll be like, man, how could God let something like that happen? And one of the problems that we have is that we view things in terms of, I'm entitled to this many years of life. I'm entitled to this quality of life. And if I get less than that, it's because God took it from me. But in reality, God made you. You didn't do anything to earn God making you. You didn't do anything to earn God giving you anything that you have. All of it is bonus. When you have someone who's born without the ability to see, you're not entitled to the ability to taste. You're not entitled to the ability to smell. You're not entitled to the ability to touch. You're not entitled to the ability to hear. And you're not entitled to the ability to see. And so when someone is born, for example, lacking one of their senses, it's not that we're excited about that, but we weren't entitled to any of it. And so Job has the proper understanding of, I brought nothing into this world. I'm not entitled to anything. For a time, God gave me, and now God's taken away. Am I going to accept good from God, but that's it? If God gives me anything else, then I'm going to get upset with him. And so one of the problems is we view the world with a sense of, I am owed this much from God, instead of everything I have is extra. Every day I live, every breath I take, everything I see, everything I taste, everything I do, it's all extra. But Job has that mentality, and that is what enables him to respond this way to suffering. And so we need to have that mentality. But it doesn't stop there. Chapter 2. And again, a day came when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? This is the same question as last time. And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. Same description as the first chapter. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. This is another thing that's repeated. Job is not suffering because he did something wrong. It's not to say that Job was perfect, but Job, the book of Job, is making very clear Job's not responsible for what's happening to him. But here's the second thing that should be surprising to you. Let's read verse 3 again. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Who does God attribute Job's suffering to? Who does God say brought about Job's suffering in verse 4? What is it?
Satan.
It's not Satan.
God.
Who said it? God. God says, although you incited me against him. And so even though Satan is the one who actually carried it out, God's the one who allowed it. And in the very first place, Satan's not the one who came to God and said, hey, God, let me at Job. God said, have you seen Job? God actually volunteered Job for this suffering. And then when Satan asked, "Can I make him suffer?" God said, "Yes." God knew what he was doing the whole time. God doesn't have this idea that suffering comes from Satan and my hands are clean of it. In Deuteronomy, God says, "I am the one who kills and makes alive. I am the one who wounds. I am the one who heals, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand." And it's not to say that God's responsible for sin, but God is not outside of the realm of suffering. It's not like suffering happens without his knowledge or approval. We talked about that on Sunday when we were going through Psalm 88. If God's not the one who's responsible for, if God is not the one who allowed suffering to enter my life, then God can't help me once it's there. And so it's actually an important thing that even suffering is within God's power. And that's another one of the questions that Job ends up answering. Okay, so Satan said to answer, then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life, but stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life." And now we're going to see the affliction of Job's body. We've seen the destruction of his possessions, but now we're going to see what Satan does to his body. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took a broken piece of pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in his ashes. That's an extraordinarily painful disease. Off the top of my head, I have forgotten what it's called. But boils are like large pimples all over your body. Pimples are already pretty uncomfortable, and having to pop those suckers hurts really bad. So just imagine that you've got big pimples from the sole of your feet to the crown of your head. Your entire body's covered. What is it?
Like you're stepping on
them. Yeah, you're stepping on them, you're sitting on them, all of it. And then he's having to scrape it off with broken pottery as he sits in ashes and mourns the death of all of his kids and the loss of everything he owned. Job is having a bad day. Job had more to lose than anyone else in the country, and he had less reason to lose it than anyone else in the country, and Job is having a bad day.
I think that's all of our bad days and our whole entire lifetime combined.
Straight up. No, yeah. Job is suffering more in the span of like maybe a week than most of us will suffer in our entire life. It's brutal.
Why does he have to scrape them
off? I don't know. Why do you have to pop pimples? I'm not entirely sure. I didn't look into it. I just know it hurts. I didn't look into why he has to take them off. I just know that it hurts really bad. And that's kind of the main point, at least. But I'll have to look into it. And then in verse 9, "And then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die.'" Such good advice. I love it. So my brother Jackson, this is one of his favorite parts of the book of Job, not because he hates women, because he thinks this is funny, is that Satan is like, "I have got the ability to kill everyone in Job's life, take everything he owns away from him, and do everything to him except kill him. Would it hurt Job more if I killed his wife or if I left her alive?" And Satan decided that his wife was more useful to Satan alive. That's rough, man. Which, to be fair, his wife also just lost everything she had and all of her kids. So I'm not saying, like, oh, this loser of a woman. No. But also, that's funny. Okay, so, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Sometimes it's hard to listen. Sometimes it's hard to ignore bad advice. Let's see how Job responds. Job's struggle bussing. His day has not gotten any better. He's now sick, and his wife is telling him, just curse God and die. So he's got bad advice coming in. He has no positive influences. He's having a hard time. Let's see what he does. And then in verse 10, "But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?' And in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips." So not only is Job refusing to sin himself, he looks at the attitude of his wife, who's not thinking about this the way that she should, and then he says, "Honey, try to think about this a little bit differently." So even in his own suffering, he's helping her see the situation properly. That's insane. I know a lot of guys who, like, they have a bad day and then they lash out on the people around them. Like, they have a bad day, and instead of being kind and understanding to their wife or kids, they come home from work after a, you know, particularly rough one, and they yell at their kids or they yell at their wife or they get into it. Job's having the worst day possible, and not only is he not cursing God, he's also continuing to be a good husband to his wife. That's, like, crazy. And it's an important thing. Just because you're having a bad day, just because you're not experiencing what you'd like to experience, it doesn't give you an excuse to sin. And so Job's an example of that. So we've seen Job's, the destruction of Job's possessions. We've seen the affliction of Job's body. The last thing that we're going to look at as we go through this introduction is Job's friends and Job's sorrow. Job's friends and Job's sorrow. And I've been reading the entire thing thus far, but we're not going to read the entirety of the remainder of it, because we've got to move a bit more quickly. But in verse 11, it says, "Now Job's three friends heard of all the evil that had come upon him, and they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment to come to. They made an appointment together to come show sympathy and comfort him." "And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his suffering was very great." Now, sometimes Job's friends get a bad rap. But here's one of the things, one of the practical lessons that I learned from the book of Job. Sometimes when you've got someone who's going through a hard time, what we tend to want to do is to see them having a really rough time and be like, "Hey man, God is sovereign. God's a happy God. Put a smile on that face. Turn that frown upside down." And we try to tell them the things that are going to make them feel better. And we try to come in there and try to make the hurt go away. And that's not actually the best way to comfort someone who's suffering. You're supposed to weep with those who weep, mourn with those who mourn. And so Job's friends come, and for 7 days and seven nights, they sit with him in the ash, saying nothing. When is the last time you have done anything remotely similar to that? I can't remember the last time that I've done something like that. Job's friends care about him. They care about him genuinely. And so they're sitting around him, and they're not speaking. And in your own life, when you're trying to comfort someone who's struggling, sometimes sitting next to them and listening to what they have to say, or sitting with them in silence, just feeling their hurt with them, is going to be more helpful and more effective than anything else you could do. And the problem is that's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to be in someone's hurt like that. We'd rather make the hurt go away. And so that's why we immediately try to fill the air with, like, advice. But genuinely feeling someone's pain with them, one of the best lessons you're going to learn about comforting someone who's in pain. And Job's friends do that really well. It's not until they open their mouths that things go another direction. But then in chapter 3, after 7 days, and they sat with him 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his suffering was very great. And so after 7 days, after some of the worst events that have ever happened to an individual, now Job speaks. And in chapter 3, we're not going to go through the whole thing, but in chapter 3, verses 3 through 4, Job says, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived,' let that day be darkness, and may God above not seek it nor shine upon it." If you've ever heard someone say, "I curse the day of my birth," that's basically what Job's doing. He's like, "I curse the day I was born." In verses 11 through 13, he says, "Why did I not die at birth? Come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept, and then I would have been at rest." And then further down, which we're seeing this, and like you can kind of feel the pain in that. Like, Job's feeling real pain. It's not like he has some righteousness shield that makes everything go well for him, and even when the bad times come, he's able to smile through it, impervious to the pain. Righteousness doesn't mean that bad things don't happen to you, and righteousness doesn't mean that the bad things hurt less. Job's in genuine pain. in chapter 3, verses 20 to 22. He says, why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than hidden treasures? Those who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave. He's saying, life, why would I be alive just to suffer? If I had never existed, maybe I wouldn't have been able to enjoy life, but I also wouldn't be able to suffer this much. And if I'm going to suffer more than I'm going to enjoy, wouldn't it have been better to just die? And in his situation, I can kind of see why he's thinking like that. In 26, he concludes his thought and he says, I am not at ease. I am not quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. Like, even after all of his possessions are lost, it's like, man, that's pretty bad. And then he's sitting there for a little while, just processing the fact that his entire life just ended. And while he's doing that, boom, soars. It's like, seriously? It's like when you're in a movie and you're like, can this day get any worse? And then it starts raining. That's basically the experience that Job had. He's like, at least I have a moment to just process what happened. Soars. Like, it immediately gets worse. And so Job is in more pain than most people who will ever live, in a shorter period of time than most people will ever experience. And so Job is going to be an example of how people suffer, and he's going to be an example of how people think through that suffering. One of the most common questions you're going to hear is, why do good people suffer? If God's in control, why do bad things happen to good people? And Job gives us four people, plus a fifth, all sitting around a circle, having it out and discussing, how could this bad thing have happened? Whose fault is it? Why is it like this? And what we're going to be doing for the rest of the story is going through those questions, evaluating them, and then at the very end, a special guest pops on the scene. I won't spoil it for you, but it might be God. Anyways, but that sets the scene. We now see the depths of Job's suffering. We know why the suffering is happening, something that Job never finds out. And we know that it is specifically not because Job sinned. And that is the preface. That is the information and context we need for the rest of the book of Job. But I want to give you some conclusions, some things that we learn from this. First of all, Job is not suffering because Job did something to particularly deserve it, which means not all suffering is judgment. God and Satan are not two equally powered entities in a struggle. God is infinitely more powerful than Satan. Which, all of these are just important worldview issues. 3, Satan is extremely powerful. The only thing that restrains Satan is God's power. 4, Job is an example of the righteous response to suffering. Our worship of God is not predicated on God giving us what we want. And Job is a good example of the righteous response to suffering. You recognize that you were entitled to none of it, and you worship anyway. God owns us. We were made to worship God, and our fulfilling that purpose is not based on how happy we are with what God gives us. And lastly, Job's suffering is real. Righteousness is not a guarantee of a lack of suffering in this life. Sometimes you have people that they live a righteous life like they have some sort of quid pro quo with God, or if I'm righteous, you give me good things. And if that's how you're doing your righteousness, you're doing it wrong. You worship God because you love God, not because he's giving you something in return. But with that, thus the introduction to one of my favorite books in the Bible. Let's bow our heads, pray it out. We've got a little bit of time for small groups. Oh, maybe a bit less than I thought. Lord, thank you for the book of Job. Thank you that you give us an example of someone who suffered extraordinarily, even though they didn't necessarily deserve it. Thank you for this exploration of suffering in a good person's life, and I pray that you would help us to think through the things we read in Job, to grapple with the conversations that Job has with his friends, and ultimately the conversation that you have with them. And I pray that we would walk away with a deeper understanding of you and a deeper understanding of this life that you have made. Help us to be faithful, even in the worst of circumstances. Amen.